best go-to-market operators in the world are time travelers. What I mean is they're so accurate around where they're going to be 3 months from now, 2 months from now, 1 month from now. Versus like if you think about people that you've worked with in the past that may not be as effective, like they're saying like, oh, we're going to hit this goal. You travel in time 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and you're not there.
Welcome to another episode of Go-To-Market Mavericks, the podcast about go-to-market innovators, risk takers, and leaders, and the unique strategies, tactics, and playbooks they use to succeed. On with me today is Alton Wells, Director of Growth and Marketing Operations at Sigma Computing. Prior to his time at Sigma, he held various positions across product marketing, growth, ops, product itself. He even had a stint at the beginning of his career as a robotics founder. He's an avid mountain biker, climber, and just an overall outdoors enthusiast. Alton, excited to have you on today and to chop it up.
Thanks so much, Manson. I appreciate it. A lot of people choose to go into tech, right? Like, it's like they know, like, I'm gonna get a career in technology, and I'm gonna work at a tech company, and I'm gonna go to Facebook, and I'm gonna do all these things. Like, I like to think that like tech sort of found me. I mean, I was in school at the University of Arizona, and when I first got started, I had started working on this idea with a couple other co-founders for a robotics company back when drones were really new. Like, remember like the 2015, 2016 era when like the very first drones were coming out. So we had started something there, and we raised about $1 million, and I did the founder thing and exited about 2.5 years later. And then from there was a product manager, product marketer, now growth marketer and ops person. So I've sort of done the full lay of the land, if you will, of I think things that you can do with product related, growth related aspects and tech companies.
I have to ask this question because I think everybody thinks their life is so hard. But you've done all these different roles. Maybe share with me some of like your peak, like your highest peaks, and maybe some of your like lowest troughs. Like, you have a really interesting background. Would love to just hear like, okay, like this one time as a founder, or this one time as a product marketer. Just curious to get your take, because everybody has their gripes and also the things that they love about their job. You've got a smattering here.
I mean, I it's a great question, because I genuinely consider myself to be like one of the luckiest people in the world. Like, my life is so blessed. I've had such incredible opportunities, and like the pleasure to work with like really, really smart and intelligent people, like in engineering and product and design and marketing. I've had a bunch of incredible mentors who've really helped shape my mind. So it's, I don't think too often. I think when it comes to like really, really hard things, like the stuff that's personally put me in a position where I've been like, dang, like this is tough, have been like the moments where I didn't know what to do next. Right, like whether it was like we were trying to raise another round, or we were trying to pivot a product, or let's say we had like a big project and we were trying to drive a metric. It's whenever I'm sort of faced with something where I'm like, dang, this is incredibly difficult. And finding a path to like actually making that a reality is one of those moments where I don't want to say I'm necessarily down, but I can feel myself being kind of afraid or uncertain, and it's sort of like those moments where I'm like, okay, I really need to change, I really need to learn, I need to really like embrace a new methodology of doing something. And so I think like one of the examples is, you know, I oftentimes go back to like my startup, because they're just like where so many of like my foundational ideas were started. And I don't know if you've ever tried to like raise funds or like launch a product from complete scratch, but it is a daunting experience. I had a friend of mine who once said that like building a startup is simple e complicad. He's like a Portuguese guy. And I think it's so true, because like in theory, all you have to do is build something and sell it, and like build something people want. Like, there's all the little details. And so I remember when we were pivoting the product, it was just one of those times where I was like, oh man, this is an enormous amount of work. And I was having to learn how to go to market, how to sell, how to raise funds. And that sort of like kicked off my entire experience. But in general, I think I'm a pretty resilient person. And most of the time I'm like a painfully optimistic human being.
You say painfully, so I assume you've paid for your optimism in the past at some point.
Yeah, I don't think everybody shares my optimism. They're like, dude, like you need to be more realistic, and I'm like, dude, I'm like you need to be more idealistic, you know? Like, uh-huh. I think there's a lot of culture where people spend so much time trying to be realistic, and you should definitely be realistic. You should be aware of like the realistic paths of like failure and success and best case and worst case. Like at Sigma, we have this incredible go-to-market motion. Like we have one of the most data-driven go-to-market motions you can possibly imagine. And so we have all of these forecasts for how we're going to do in the very best of cases, in the middle of cases, the most likely of cases. And I tend to just sort of default in almost all aspects of my life where I'm like, we should just choose to be as optimistic as possible. We should choose to go for like the best incredible thing. And if you fail, if you miss, it's kind of like shoot for the moon. If you miss, you hit the stars type of mentality. Sometimes you miss, and like sometimes when you're on experiments as well, like you're never going to get it right, but you're not going to get it right all the time. But in general, I think optimism is a pretty good practice.
Yeah, love those points. I think that for me, you need to account for what can go wrong. I think that's like that's just being prudent. But the only way to me to operate effectively is to operate as though you're going to succeed, right? Like, okay, like you set out to succeed, therefore operate that way. And should you fail, because that is always a risk, especially the bigger your ambitions, you know, the more risk there is, right? But like, accepting that risk and moving along and just saying, you know what, we're going to do our best to succeed, is totally aligns with like, you know, my approach and how I approach things. Depending on the audience that I'm with, I think I don't know how people would respond to like a survey about Mattson and like what my where I fall on that scale.
I think more is a mixed bag, dude.
And it's really honestly dependent on like what context I'm in, who are the people giving feedback. But I would say I'm a realist, but I do lean optimistic. I think I've become more, I started out way on the hyper, like optimistic, like idealist side. Yes. And then like, as life has gone on,
it just wheels you down. You're like, dang, I gotta get realistic about this.
And I'm just more aware of like all of like the, you know, when you build like a model or something, right? You're like, your initial models, like when you're younger or like that you build your growth models or whatever, they're like full of these assumptions that you're just like, you're blissfully unaware of like the number of risks associated with those guesses that you're taking. And I think that's just generally like, with your life, like it's just kind of how it happens. Like you still have to account for those things, but you got to operate in an optimistic fashion.
You know, one of the phrases I really like, and I tend to think this is pretty true, is like, you should definitely not have a plan B. Like, I think there should be a plan A.
Ooh.
And like, there should be like, everyone wants to have multiple plans. Like, oh, what about this? What about this? And then there are like contingencies around like, well, if this doesn't work, we need to change something. I don't necessarily think that's like a plan B. Plan B is like, oh, you know, I'm gonna take on this project and it doesn't work, we're gonna try like, you know, we need to switch to this entirely different methodology of thinking or this entire different methodology. And maybe there's some instances that were correct, but I think when it comes to like your psychology as a person and like being really, really effective, like if you're focused on like actually achieving one specific set of goals, having a plan A, at least in my mind, and like a real plan too, like I think as I get older, like having a real plan versus like a half thought out plan tends to be a bit more effective because you kind of know where you want to go. But I think to your point too, around like risk and as we get older, like I'm 30 years old now, I just turned 30. And I remember when I was 20, 21, like having a very cognitive, like conversation with myself where I was like, I have infinite like risk threshold. I was like, I can take infinite risk right now. But the reality is, like, as you get older, as you go into your 30s and then into your 40s and into your 50s, like, your threshold for risk is dramatically reduced.
Yeah.
Like, you have to operate on a very thin margin of, like, what you need to achieve. And, like, you can't just, like, completely throw a Hail Mary and hope it works out. Like, you have to be meticulous. And some of the best go-to-market operators I know now, like, some of the, like, incredible leaders, especially here at Sigma, like, they're so good at predicting the future, of like predicting what they're going to do and how they're going to hit. And they've built these systems to actually meticulously hit those numbers. And it's almost like an art form. Like they're so good at it. They're so accurate. They're so precise. And it's like endearing. You're like, oh my God, like how do you consistently do this? It's like magicians. I mean, in general, I'm an optimist that's trying to be as realistic as possible.
Love it. You mentioned that at Sigma, you got some pretty sophisticated systems for, you know, forecasting and, you know, modeling, and sounds like you got your metrics in order. what's your North Star right now in your role there at Sigma? And what are some of the systems that you guys have in place to kind of like help you? You know, what are you all doing to the extent that you can share at Sigma that you think would be maybe valuable for those who are listening?
So, again, I feel really blessed because Sigma is, and I say this as objectively as I possibly can, Sigma is probably the world's best platform for working with data. And I don't mean that as a plug. I just mean it as like rationally. Before this, I was at a company called Heap, which was like products and website analytics. And so, you know, I got a taste of you know, data-driven products, metric-driven products around user activity and behavior, which is really, really insightful. But at Sigma, it's sort of like this whole new world, right? It's kind of like you open the Pandora's box of data where you can sort of see literally every single bit of data you can possibly capture and combine it and mess with it and do it in a really interested and intuitive way. So like we have the ability in marketing specifically to like really see, not just like on an attribution level, which we can talk about later, because I think we both share very specific thoughts. And I think many people would agree with us that attribution is a tricky subject. But like very specifically, like you asked the question, like on our North Star, like we're very focused on opportunity creation. And I think in B2B SaaS, that's a very common thing. You call it like SQLs, you call it opportunities, you call it meetings, whatever core metric you is, but like, or that you have. For us, like we have really intricate details and models around like where our opportunities are coming from, how our opportunities are created, opportunities by campaign, where they're coming from, the field team or the growth team or demand gen or paid channels, organic, like social, you name it. And so we have this really sophisticated way of being able to look at how, not just how we're doing and how we're pacing, really like where we're forecasted to hit. And I think that was something in prior roles that I hadn't really seen, is the ability to sort of meticulously say like, we're pacing at, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80% of goal. Here's where we're at today. Here's where we're going to be in 4 to 5 weeks. Here's where we're going to be at the end of the quarter. And I've kind of had this idea recently over the past couple of weeks and months that like, the best go-to-market operators in the world, and I don't mean this in like a silly fashion. I almost mean this in like a very real way. The best go-to-market operators in the world are time travelers. And like, what I mean is they're so accurate around where they're going to be 3 months from now, 2 months from now, 1 month from now, versus like if you think about people that you've worked with in the past that may not be as effective, like they're saying like, oh, we're going to hit this goal. You travel in time 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and you're not there. But the really, really good ones, they can say like, hey, like we're going to be at exactly this point within this range in at the end of the quarter. And so for marketing, to the original question, like the core metrics for us are like, you know, how many opportunities are we creating? How many meetings are we producing? How many page visits are we doing? And like, how do all those from like a downstream funnel perspective actually mean or actually equate to opportunities in all of our segments, and whether it's enterprise or commercial, like you name it. And we have the ability to sort of look and I forget the word of it, where you sort of like, you know, you when you're in science, you kind of like take apart the frog and you can kind of look at your entire body. There's like a word for that. We can really sort of meticulously see the performance of our entire business from the top to bottom. And like, that's just like the start. So, we look at every metric, but for us at the end of the day, it's always about opportunity creation.
You know, as you're mentioning this time traveler concept, and that some people are really good at calling their shot, we all call our shot. We have to call our shot, right, in our profession. I guess what I'm hearing from you is that you really have a grasp on the like micro inputs to this map, like this big growth puzzle. And the better you can understand how each of those individual pieces and levers works on its own, the more accurate you're going to be in like predicting how the end result is going to like come about, because you can literally like say like, I know that like here, instead of one big like aggregate formula, you got like all these different pieces. I don't know. Does that resonate?
Yeah,
it
really does. I think part of it too is like when you do top down, everybody wants to make $100 million, right? Like, I don't know, B2B company in the world that doesn't want to make $100 million. Everybody, every go-to-market CEO, operator on planet Earth who runs like a business that's actually producing revenue wants to make $100 million. It's kind of like the hallmark of like establishing something really successful for all of the reasons, right? Whether you're a founder or you're you're an early employee, or even if you're joining the company relatively like $100 million. And there are probably a million paths to $100 million. And there are so many ways to get there. Like, you can invest really, really heavily in a sales team. You can do like boots on ground. You can really do like door-to-door marketing. You can do phone calls. You can spend a ton of effort and energy building a community and doing UGC. Like, there's some fast-growing companies right now who sort of captured the cultural zeitgeist, and they don't even really have a sales team. And then there are logical reasons for doing both of them. And I think like everybody wants efficiency too. Like, you know, don't get me wrong, everyone wants to make $100 million for the lowest possible costs. Like, if you can do that, you know, all of the benefits of being a good operator. And I think when we look at our data and we look at the information that's available to us, it's not just top down of like, hey, here's the goal, but it's simultaneously like, how do each of these incremental, like whether it's SEO, whether it's organic, whether it's, you know, paid advertising, whether it's, you know, outbound marketing, whether it's community and events, whether it's like, how do those combine to create sort of this synthetic package of opportunities that we're going to produce for ourselves? And like, really, where do we know that we need to invest? And I think the reality is that that's different for every single company out there. There is no specific template for building a good market organization that's super effective that should work exactly the same at every organization, because every product is different, every company is different, every team is different. And you sort of just need to understand, in my opinion, what's working. And then the reality is, and I think this is probably a good transition and probably something that we should talk about too, is like, there's so many new tools coming out these days that are kind of like reinventing how people go to market. And that can do automation, that you can use AI. And you know, we're like 19 months into AI. I think like 19 months is pretty accurate, maybe a little less.
I think that's when like the when AI truly entered like the zeitgeist, like in full force, is like, let's call it 19
Sam
months.
Sam Altman tweeted in like the fall of 22 about GPT-3, but like nobody really cared about GPT-3. It was like 3.5, when people were like, oh my God, like generative AI is wild. And then it really wasn't until I think spring, late winter of 23, when everyone was like, holy shit, like this is like, you compressed human knowledge into these little matrices, and now all I have to do is just ask it and get a response and you can do magic. And so I think that's just one element of a lot of what's changing, which actually goes a lot to you. I'm curious too, you know, you guys have sort of built Common Room, and you know, we've been looking at you guys for a little bit, and I'm curious, like, what brought you to Common Room, man? Like, what was the big sell?
So I came to Common Room feels like a long time ago. It's 2.5 years, which is light years. We actually built Common Room in a really unique way on accident, right? Like, it was delivered at the time, and then, you know, this is like history according to Mattson. So like, you know, Linda, CEO of Common Room, if you're listening, you know, if I say anything wrong, please feel free to call me out. But like the way that I perceive the past is, that, you know, we went out and we did go out and build an amazing tool for people in community and in DevRel. And it's still a segment that we have a great tool that still works for those customers today. And many of the features that we're launching for, you know, today work both for go-to-market use cases and, you know, community and DevRel, which are kind of an extension of go-to-market. But at the time, I was at Neo4j, which is a open source company. We were doing a bunch of user journey work, like we were like even talking about trying to understand like how do people actually like find out about us, onboard, learn, like all that. And what we realized is like we didn't have the right inputs to like improperly inform what truly causes activation in the product, because you have the product and it's just a little box, but then there's all this stuff around the product. Some of it which you have control, which is like your first party data. But some of it you don't have complete control over, right? You got like your Stack Overflows, and you've got Reddit, and you've got like these different channels that people are telling me in interviews, hey, I'm learning about you guys through this, or I actually found out about you like 3 years ago in some like random guy's YouTube video, or like there's just all this stuff that you just like can't account for. And I remember like banging my head against the wall with myself and then like the analyst I was working with to figure out like what is like our hypothesis around like our customer segmentation. Like, we got to have that right in order to like set things up properly for activation, because that was my role at the time, with self-serve activation and acquisition. Well, I came across Common Room as an opportunity. And at the time, Common Room was helping people uncover, like, de-anonymize and uncover what's happening, especially with, like, open source communities, other product communities, and figuring out, like, who are these people? How are they contributing to your overarching, like, goals as a company? And I was like, dang, like, that's a really hard problem. And I know there are, like, a million CMOs out there who are, like, banging their head against the same wall that I am, who would, like, want to understand, like, how, like, their community and the broader community, the broadest sense of the word, how is that impacting things? Because they're out there blowing money, right? Blowing money, right? According to internal stakeholders on, you know, tactics that, you know,
I think everybody in the world is tired of spending money on Google search.
Right. And, like, you're spending money. It's like, but, like, what's happening? And, like, the question is, like, okay, yeah, we're spending money on, like, we're building this community program or whatever. And it's like, what's it doing for the business? And it was a hard question to answer for a long time. Yes. So Common Room came along and built this system and got really, really good at identifying people and then enriching those people with all this really interesting data so that you could truly have, like, a person 360 on this person's, like, entire journey across, like, time. And so
Oh, no, what's super interesting is, like, you guys, in theory, you guys solve one of the biggest problems that I think exists in, like, future go-to-market, right? If we can think, like, there's a future state in, like, the 2040 version of, like, effective B2B go-to-marketing, and even consumer, I think consumer is even harder. Like, really, mm-hmm. really good consumer marketing is also very simple and complicated. But for B2B, one of the challenges, and I have, like, this dream, and this dream that, like, one day we'll be able to have, like, perfectly autonomously updated models of each individual in our target markets so that, like, all of our data sets and all of our customer data sets across all of our databases are, like, unified around, like Madsen works at Common Room. Madsen used to work here. Madsen lives in Washington, and his favorite hobby is mountain biking, or, you know, I actually don't know what his favorite hobby is, but, like, you have all of these data points that are actively being updated all the time. And I think part of, like, there's this thing that I've been thinking a lot about, it's called, like, the unified theory of go-to-market. And it's sort of like a play on, like, the unified theory of physics. Yep. And I think there's part of the piece of a unified theory of go-to-market is that you need to fundamentally understand in detail everything you can about the individual people inside of your audiences. And in order to do that, like, it is impossible to do it without automation. And it is impossible to do it without enrichment. And it is impossible to do it without, like, a form of AI agents going out and collecting this data for you. And the way that I think about this is, like, we're in early innings. Like, this is like inning one, maybe inning two of where things are going. And the tools are really starting to come together now. And I think a part of it too is, like, even with Sigma, you need these data analytics platforms to understand all these actions. And you need these tools to do enrichments. And you need these tools to do AI workflows. And so, to me, I think we're in this really interesting early period where the entire philosophy of how go-to-market teams can effectively operate is fundamentally being turned on its head. Completely being flipped 180 on how you can do things and how you can do things as a good market professional.
Yeah, no, that's really, really interesting to have you frame it up that way, that unified GTM theory.
I'm
going to
write a book one day. It's going to be called the theory of go-to-market.
Count me on your early readers list. On the flip side of this outreach and on the flip side of companies trying to make money, it's like, it all starts with an end user and a customer or a prospect, right? And they're humans. We are not cyborgs yet, right? No. And, like, I prefer that we stay human.
Me too.
And so I think where we've struggled in the past is that we've had automation and enrichment to an extent, and, like, we've had them in the future what will look like extremely nascent forms.
Agreed.
But we have not had the ability to layer in, like, a human element to this automation. And so it comes off as robotic. And so you end up with this natural friction of, like, human machine clashing.
I have this slide, and maybe I wish I could just, like, put it up, right? I have this slide.
Yeah.
And on
show
one
notes.
Side, yeah, maybe we can cut it in. But like at one point, there's it's like a gradient, and there's two gradients, right? On the left hand side, it says like things robots are really good at doing, and then it says like things robots are really bad at doing, and then it's inverted, and it says things human beings like to do, and on the other side it says like things human beings don't like to do, and you'd be surprised. The things, or maybe not surprised at all, the things that human beings really like to do are usually what robots are really, really bad at doing. Like, I think about like the modern day Salesforce. I'm not gonna like Salesforce as a company. I mean, like building a sales team, which is like
it's
an essential part. Like at Sigma, we have probably one of the most elite sales teams in B2B SaaS right now. Like, I genuinely don't think you could have like a more elite team of like how we go to market with sales. And if you think about the things that we ask our sales teams to do, we say like, we want you to send repetitive LinkedIn messages. We want you to send repetitive cold emails. I was a product marketer for a long time. We used to like write emails. Like, this is exactly what you need to say for this product launch. And here's the sequence. And this is what you send next. And this is what you insert. And then if they're interested in these things, this is what you want to say to them. And if they're interested in this stuff, here's the page that you want to say to them. All of those things are horrible asks for human beings to do. Because in theory, really, in my mind, especially when you're doing the initial form of outreach, where you're doing outbound, that's all awareness marketing. Like, sales at the very first top of the funnel, when you're reaching out to people, that's in a lot of ways, it is a marketer's purview, because it's awareness marketing. And what's really interesting to me is that salespeople don't want to send messages. They don't want to send LinkedIn DMs. They don't want to send cold emails. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity in terms of automation. There's tools in place that do it now. And I think it's going to be more sophisticated as time goes on. And then on the flip side, like, if you think about what human beings are really good at, what robots are terrible at, it's like building relationships. Like, you're never going to trust ChatGPT to like deeply understand like who you are and who we are. And the relationship that we create is like two growth marketers trying to build and grow businesses. And so like, you should never, ever, ever, ever have an AI brokering a deep relationship or creating deep connections. That makes no sense. But you probably should have an AI like maybe helping you send like mass LinkedIn messages or like send emails or create content copy. And I think, again, we're at the very early innings of how you do things with these tools. And right now it's very janky. And I think over time it's going to get extremely elegant and extremely sophisticated. And you're going to have billion-dollar businesses created on this entire notion of like automating these entire go-to-market workflows.
Yeah. Well, love that. I think it's, you know, good news for both of our respective businesses right now. The need for data to do so, and then also like the need to piece all of this together and help people take action on it. There's this, I can't remember which tool it was, but I was listening to we tried this thing where we like tested a podcast conversation on a blog post that we wrote. Mm-hmm. And essentially like taking a look at your blog and then like generate a like two-person, like we're doing right now.
Is it with like Notebook LLM?
I think it is. I think it is. So like, and this is, I'm not trying to trash anybody or anything, right? Like, we actually, we were trying to figure out, like, is this a thing? But as I was listening to it, I was amazed at how good it was. But at the same time, I was like, fundamentally, when I listen to a podcast, it's a very human thing. And I feel like close to the podcast host that I subscribe to. And like, I almost feel like there's a human relationship there that doesn't exist in a lot of mediums. And I found myself fundamentally rejecting like this idea that like I should be listening to two AIs speaking to each other. But at the same time, like, there are other moments where like voice and AI should absolutely go together. But it's just interesting. It'll be interesting to discover what are the mediums where like AI can be useful in go-to-market, and where is it absolutely no right now and potentially not in the future. Yeah. Anyway, just a personal anecdotal experience with that.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, before we started recording, you asked me an interesting question. You said like, you know, like, what are the like some of the marketers that you really look up to, or like who are the people that you're like dang, like they're doing interesting work. I think one of my contra takes on this is like, I don't know if you're on like, do you watch like YouTube Shorts? Do you watch like Instagram Shorts? Do you ever just like find yourself scrolling?
I would say no. So
okay,
like,
wow, good for you. You're healthier than the rest of us. So like, if you're on YouTube Shorts, or if you're other on,
I'm a dad of three right now, man. So like, my life is like my Instagram Shorts are like
keep
stepping outside.
Yeah, there's this concept called brain rot, Okay. And like, it's like Gen Z marketing. And so what happens is that they put like these video game backgrounds and it's like the most random abstract things in the world. And then they have like AI voiceover. And there's been studies on this. And there's actually a post that I saw really recently where somebody had taken like a really hard concept and they put it behind what like the brain rot strategy, where you sort of have like just this random animation in the background, just doing random stuff. And the ability for, and it's specifically targeted at young people, for them to retain that information actually was a lot higher than when they were just fed like a high quality form of information like this. And so I think a lot of what could happen in the future, like this is one of the best possibilities, and I think it's likely going to happen, is that you have these like AI generative conversations, this AI generative content packaged in a way that isn't a facsimile of real human conversation. It's not like an AI generated version of me and an AI generated version of you, and it's just like AI generatively going back and forth. Like, I think that's cheap, and I think people are always going to be able to tell. Like, there's that kind of like uncanny valley where like we're a long ways away from like a perfect replication of human interaction. However, I would bet that if you took this conversation, and then you packaged like the most interesting bits, and then you put it behind like gated like content with just some background in the back, and then like transcription and a little person talking over, and even if it was an AI synthesized version of this, where it's just like the highlights and talking points, that's what content does really, really well. And so it's the Gen Z marketers, man. They're the ones that are just doing the craziest things. And, you know, they're building these, like, I saw this one post of like this like 19-year-old who had like a 500K MRR consumer Apple like iPhone app. And it was just like the simplest thing. And he just did it all through like TikTok and YouTube marketing. And I was like, I don't know what we're doing. You know, like they're onto something crazy.
That's, yeah, super, super interesting. I have to say that, yeah, I mentioned I'm not on TikTok a lot. I was on it for like a hot second during COVID, like everyone. And then I thought to myself, this is going to like just take my entire day. So I jumped off. But I have hope. My colleagues joke that, you know, I've got three kids. Oldest is 7 now, and or 8. She just turned 8. And I'm going to become really cool soon. I'm going to be a really cool marketer soon. She's going to show me all the tricks.
You're going to be ahead of the curve, man.
Yeah, Gen Alpha, man. So we all know, it's no secret that like 2023 was really hard, broadly speaking. Like some companies are doing much better than others, but on the average, it was more difficult. And 2024 is, you know, maybe some of us are coming out of it to an extent, but there's still a lot of teams out there really struggling with like pipeline generation. You're going to generate pipeline. And there's a really strong need from like the C-suite to say, hey, like, show me the money. Like, what is actually leading to revenue? What is actually leading to pipeline? And I think one of the challenges that demand gen, less so demand capture, but like demand gen and like top of funnel growth initiatives carry with it, is that it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to just like point to like, but trust me, you almost, many people get in a situation where they feel like their argument is, trust me, it's working. Look at the numbers. Trust me, this is working. And so like, I'm curious to hear your perspective on like marketers that find themselves in that position, or on the other side, it's like marketers who are stuck in like the vicious cycle of like chasing attribution, like if their life depended on it. Like
I'm very lucky to have some really great mentors, CMOs at some very, very large companies. And I've had this exact conversation with them. One of them is a head of CMO at a multi-billion dollar corporation. And I've had this conversation. We're sitting down with dinner about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And like, we both agree that like attribution is a wild goose chase. Yeah. And very, very, very distracting to doing really good marketing. Giant asterisk, you should know your attribution. Like, you should know how you're doing on social. You should know how much is coming from organic. You should know how much is coming from Google and Bing and all of your other paid channels. You should know if you should reinvest inside of YouTube. You should know what is going on in terms of your business. Like, I think this goes back to the conversation earlier, where like, you have the fundamental building blocks of your entire go-to-market strategy, and a lot of it goes to understanding how you're performing across these channels. And then really, you know, the true theory behind attribution is that you understand like what's just getting you attention and what's actually getting you business. Because if a good attribution model tells you that like, hey, you know, we're making, let's just say 100,000 opportunity or 100 opportunities, and it costs us X number of dollars from X, Y, and Z channels, and Y is just working really, really well. Well, you should keep doing Y. Like, it's the fundamental premise of like what's working. However, what I've seen very often, and I've talked to other marketers about this, is that they get caught in the vicious cycle. It's like, well, this is what attribution is. This is what the attribution is. This is what the attribution is. So we have to just do this one thing. And it sort of becomes like analysis paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at some of the companies that have done really incredible marketing and like really incredible growth, my favorite case study of, I think, a company that just captured the cultural zeitgeist, especially in like the 2015, 2020 era, was Webflow. Like Webflow, if you're a designer, if you're a web developer, if you build sites, they produced this incredible series of content. And they were creating YouTube videos and trailers and ads, and they had a university and they had templates, and they had built all of these crazy mechanisms for getting people to sign up. I have a hard time believing that you would come up with that strategy based on attribution alone. I don't think you're going to sit there and say like, oh, well, you know, paid isn't working, so, or paid is working, so let's do more paid. Like nothing that they did, or Google search is working, let's just do more Google search. So much of what they did was based around like a fundamental understanding of who your audience is and where they live and how to create value for them. And I think a good marketer, like a really good marketer who has a strong degree of empathy for their audience, is going to understand that like there's some things that are going to be very difficult to quantify, especially in the early days. And as you're building programs, as you're building campaigns, as you're building initiatives, as you're building earned, as you're building sort of the critical mass that you're going to build your larger good market initiatives on, you sometimes, oftentimes, just have to do things on vibes. Like, is it a good idea? And like, do the smart people that are working with you all think that this is a good idea? Even if you don't have the data, it is probably a good decision. Like, creating a university is like one of their biggest things that they did at Webflow. That like, they did this university content. I think it's some of the smartest things that they ever did is that they created a series of university content, and then they marketed that university content, and then they retargeted that content, and they created trailers for their educational courses. And so you created this crazy mechanism. And I bet once you get that working, you can do crazy attribution. You can tell you which videos are working, which series are working, what content, and what integrations are really, really interesting. But to get something off the ground, to get something new, I don't think you can do that from a first attribution basis. Like, you sort of just have to be like, this is something that's worth doing, and place your bets. Like, you sort of need to like see how much money and like how much effort you want to put behind like unique ideas. And I think everybody should reserve a significant chunk of their efforts, especially early, in building new things that have high yield. It's like the Amazon, it's a modified like Jeff Bezos theory, where like Jeff Bezos says, he's like, if there's like a 1% chance of having like 1,000x return, you should almost always do it. And like, those are the methodologies that early stage founders who are building something understand. But I think there's probably a psychological gap between the people who've never started something or who don't have that experience and who've been in these traditional structures should consider adopting because it lets them be just infinitely more successful doing infinitely more creative things.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That makes me just think about like when you're a young startup and you're hiring for your first growth roles, your first product roles, your first like roles that are like, I just think it's so important to index pretty heavily on like demonstrated experience making choices with little information, because that's ultimately what you are being tasked to do. We as humans, we like gravitate towards things that are, you know, easy and comfortable. And it is not, you mentioned at the very beginning, one of the hardest places you've been is like not knowing what to do in a really hard situation, right? Being met with that, like that void, so to speak. And I feel like the earlier you are on in a go-to-market motion, the more likely you're going to be confronted with that reality on a relatively consistent basis.
All the time.
And so being able to, to me, it's like there's quantitative data, and there's qualitative data, and then there's earned data. Like you earned it in like with prior experience and hard knocks, right? Yeah, totally. There's qualitative information from your prospects and your core customers. And if you don't know them yet, go out and get it, like go out and figure it out. And then third is like quantitative. And I feel like these three things build on each other. You got to have like founder market, you know, professional market fit. Like, do I have empathy for this user? Can I get there fast? You start to talk to real people. And then you start taking swings based on that limited amount of information. You start to see what's working. And then to your point, then you can start to get the really fancy and, to be frank, amazing dashboards and everything that tells you. And so these are the exact dials. So you don't get... Yeah.
It's the difference between like building the rocket and dialing the knobs, right? Like,
yeah,
you need to build the rocket first before you can like dial in the exact orbital mechanics and like really get like the launch down. And it's funny. I think when I was in high school, I wanted to be an astrophysicist, and then my calculus teacher told me that's probably not a good idea. And I was like, fair enough. he came up to me and he was like, what do you want to be again? And I was like, I want to study astrophysics. And he was like, okay. And I was like, heard. But the funny thing behind it is, I think a lot of the metaphor around like launching something and putting it into orbit can be applied to like so many aspects of business. And when you're trying to create and launch something, you're not going to have like all of the specific little dials that you can move to perfectly manipulate the outcome. You just sort of need to like that. I think Sam Altman tweeted something recently too, where he was like, sometimes you just need to launch like a flaming pile of garbage into orbit, and you just learn something by getting the garbage into orbit, which is better than like trying to launch something perfect. And so that's part of the curse of attribution. And I think like to not the last point, but something I see in really good go-to-market professionals, whether it's like a CEO, an operator, a salesperson, a marketer, is that like they're really comfortable in the pocket. And it's like from like a quarterback metaphor of like football. Like there's that idea that like a really good quarterback, when you have a ton of stuff coming at you and you have like the safeties that are rushing, they're about to tackle you and you know you're going to get hit, can stay really calm, stay focused on like actually completing the pass or running the ball or doing whatever it is they need to do and completing the play. And it's the professionals that are calm in the pocket that can sort of say like, okay, like this is what I need to do, and do it in a really calm and meticulous manner and then execute against it, are the ones that are world-class. And like the world-class like operators are the ones that like are driving these businesses forward and creating like massive impact. And so, yeah.
Love that analogy. And I guess like to kind of bring it together. Yeah, I think we've talked about AI, right? Let's think about taking this metaphor a step further. We talked about AI and its impact on go-to-market completely changing the way we need to think about it, right? So that represents change. That represents the safety coming off the side. You've got new ways to go to new demands from our prospects and the people out there like buying things, right? You've got changes in funding, like the whole funding environment, especially around SaaS, is like completely changed. So there's a lot of change on the horizon. And professionals who are going to succeed are those who are comfortable in that pocket spot. So, really appreciate you kind of bringing it full circle there. This has been a blast. I think there's another, hopefully we can bring you on again. If nothing else, selfishly, I really enjoyed the conversation. Where can people find you, connect with you on social or elsewhere? There are those who are hermits, and like if you don't want to be found, that's right there too.
No. It's funny. We talked about this before the podcast. I'm like a LinkedIn maximalist. I really like it's kind of like if you're on Twitter, especially tech Twitter, everybody like hates and shits on LinkedIn all the time. They're like, oh, LinkedIn's terrible. Like, why would you spend your time on LinkedIn? Yep. I love LinkedIn. I think it's like a great platform. And so I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. I'm pretty sure I'm like the only Alton Wells on LinkedIn. There might be like one other person who's a police officer in the middle of the country. So that's an easy way to find me. And I think like on closing notes too, man, like, we're at this really interesting point where like there's all of this new go-to-market tech and systems coming into place, and you have AI and you have like enrichment and you have automation. And the most fun part about it is that like we get to be a part of it, and we get to create and help shape it and build these new systems. And I think it couldn't be a more exciting time to be a marketer. And there's sort of like there's that idea of like, for the 2010s it was all about the 10x developer. I think for the 2020s or the 24 plus is really all about 10x marketing. And like, how can you really do 10x marketing? And I don't see a way around it without tools like Common Room, like Sigma, and dozens of others.
There you have it. Thanks. And we'll catch all of our listeners on the other side as we get another episode of Go To Market Mavericks.